Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The first duty we have is to really inform ourselves about this technology, about how it works. The smartphone, social media and all that kind of stuff, it's designed to be addictive. There's no way that AI or robotics is going to give any fundamental meaning.
We published an article on AI about a week ago on our Premier Unbelievable website. It was written by AI. It just shows you how far this technology is coming. But it fooled you, John.
It certainly did.
Yeah. So what do you think about all this?
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello and welcome. We're talking about how to live faithfully in a technologically confusing world today. This was a live show that Ruth Jackson and myself hosted with Dr. John Wyatt and Unbelievable listeners who joined us with their questions. Just a heads up that our next live show is on Tuesday the 7th of February. Hot button issue, sexuality, gender and identity. Two same-sex attracted Christians with different perspectives on this will be joining me. Andrew Bunt of Living Out, an author of Finding Your Best Identity, will be in conversation with Charlie Bell, the author of Queer Holiness. So do join us by registering at unbelievable.live, and you can be with us live on Tuesday the 7th of February. It's a significant moment, especially here in the UK, to be talking about such issues. The Anglican Church, just this past week, the bishops revealed plans to present to General Synod the approval of blessings for same-sex partnerships, even though they say the doctrine on same-sex marriage has not changed in the Church of England. There's been plenty in the news about that, and I'm sure we'll cover it when we have that conversation with Andrew and Charlie. So the link is there with today's show to register or go to unbelievable.live. And towards the end of today's show, we'll also hear your feedback to last week's spooky program on paranormal hauntings. As ever, if you want more from the show, you can find all our latest podcasts, articles and resources at premierunbelievable.com. And while there, register for our newsletter. We'll send you a huge amount of bonus material when you do that. It includes 12 subscriber-only videos from The Big Conversation and access to 5 ebooks, believe it or not. So you get loads of additional content when you become a newsletter subscriber. That's premierunbelievable.com. But now let's leap into today's show. Hello and welcome to today's webinar, our live show, How to Live Faithfully in a Technologically Confusing World. I'm Justin Brierley, joined by Ruth Jackson as my co-presenter, and our special guest today is Dr. John Wyatt. John is a Christian physician and research scientist who hosts the Matters of Life and Death podcast for Premier Unbelievable and is author of the book, The Robot Will See You Now. We'll meet John properly in just a moment's time. But this feels like a really prescient moment to be talking about AI. There's been so much on our news screens and media about AI and technology just recently. We do live in this almost the world of sci-fi, it feels more and more. The world is being radically changed, I think, by the biotechnology, by AI. And we end up interacting, I think, often more with digital programming than people a lot of the time. So, John, welcome. You're going to be helping us to navigate this strange new world, aren't you?
Yes, it is an amazing time to be alive, but it's a deeply confusing time at the same time, isn't it?
I should say as well, welcome to Ruth Jackson as well. Ruth,
welcome
along.
Hello.
Good to have you with us too. You'll be helping to put the questions to John tonight. How was Christmas though, John? How was New Year and all of that sort of thing?
Yeah, thanks. We had a pretty non-digital analog Christmas, meeting family and grandchildren. My wife and I have got four grandchildren, and so it was a lovely family time, actually. And it's nice to be able to put the devices down for a bit, isn't it? But now back in January, it seems like the whole thing is starting up again.
It does, yeah. The world gets back into its previous and ever faster rhythm, it feels like. But anyway, tonight we'll be able to talk about all that. Ruth, do you want to tell us where some of our viewers are joining from?
Yeah, I mean, they really are from all over the world. We've got Brazil, Sweden, quite a few people within the UK, Doncaster, Oklahoma. I'm aware that's not in the UK. Kansas, Norway. Apparently raining Southern California. I didn't even think that was a thing.
Rainy Southern California.
I know. It's very
don't
British
hear that very often.
No, I know. How very British of us to be talking about the weather again. Baltimore, Charleston, all over the place. More North Carolina, Wembley, Minnesota. Yeah, lots. Wow. Like Germany, many, many places. Nottinghamshire has just come in. Yeah. Lots of people
welcome along wherever you're tuning in from. We're so glad to have you for this, our first live show of 2023. You've been actually, you and your journalist son, Tim, part of the Premier Unbelievable Network for nearly a year now. The Matters of Life and Death podcast joined us, I think, in March last year. Tell us a little bit about that particular podcast. What's it about? What do you talk about?
Yes, I mean, it's great to be part of the Premier team. We started this podcast, my son and I, actually at the time of the pandemic, when both of us were unable to travel, and it was really a bit of an experiment. But every week we have a discussion, and it's pretty wide ranging. It started off mainly to do with medical things, particularly to do with the pandemic, lots of issues coming up about the virus and about vaccines and so on. But we've gradually extended to really anything which is either medicine, healthcare, technology, science, and related issues, trying to think through and discuss some of the challenges, trying to understand what's going on in this confusing world. And then how on earth do we go about trying to make some kind of response from a Christian perspective?
And it's got a lovely sort of father and son dynamic to it as well. I like that it is presented by a father and a son. And I always come away from every episode knowing things I didn't know when I started, and having obviously your own wise counsel to think through them as well. So thank you for it. And of course, there's a book as well, isn't there? This was the Robot Will See You Now. That was your last major published book, wasn't it?
That's right. So this came out from a research project that I was a part of. I've been fascinated by artificial intelligence for a number of years, and I managed to persuade the Faraday Institute based in Cambridge that this was a good topic for a research project. And I got together a whole bunch of scientists, theologians and so on. And eventually we wrote this book, tackling a whole range of issues based ranging from science fiction, theology, through to practical things like sex robots and employment and healthcare and so on.
John, we've heard lots about some of the challenges and opportunities of AI, but you think that this is the moment in our culture where Christians actually have an opportunity to sort of stand up and be clear about what it means to be human. Would you just share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I've been involved in areas of science and technology, starting from my background as a medic, over many years. And the interesting thing is, each time technology advances, it seems to go back to raise this fundamental question: what does it mean to be human? Mm. And often it's raising it in a new way that we haven't quite thought of before. And I think it's artificial intelligence and robotics which is raising that question in a new way. What does it mean to be human? And the interesting thing is that a lot of scientists, a lot of just ordinary people are actually asking the same question. And of course, as Christians, we do have a wonderful and profound answer. The Bible gives us a rich understanding of what it means to be human. Both a wonderful thing made out of made in God's image to reflect God's reality, but also made out of dust, incredibly vulnerable and weak and profound, and then fallen, affected by sin. So I think this understanding of what it means to be human has something very special to say in this world where robots and AI are taking over.
when it comes to some of the key players, you know, Elon Musk is obviously a name lots of people associate with the advance of technology and so on. He's almost a, you know, perfect character to star in some James Bond film, isn't he, as a super villain taking over the world with his AI and his space rockets. But to what extent has sci-fi, do you think, kind of played into this whole revolution that we're now sort of living through?
Yeah, my conviction is science fiction is far more important than most people realize. And actually, to be honest, if you really want to understand what is going on, including from a Christian, you need to read sci-fi. Because what's so interesting is that all the other technological revolutions that happen, things like, you know, the age of steam and the development of electricity and all these kind of things, the technology comes first, and then the novelists come along and write novels about it. So Charles Dickens writes about the age of steam and the Industrial Revolution and so on. What's unique about this one is that for 100 years, people have been writing and speculating about artificial intelligence, and particularly a lot of dystopian fiction about the machines battling against human beings, and also utopian worlds where the robots do everything and the human beings have nothing to do but enjoy themselves. And most of the people who work in this field, the scientists and technologists, are themselves science fiction nerds. And Elon Musk is a classic example. And he has spoken about this repeatedly, that actually he's trying to make the science fiction come true. And that's why, you know, he's read about electric cars. Okay, so we've got to make electric cars happen. We've read about rockets. And also now he's got a thing called Neuralink, where we connect the human brain to computers. These are all science fiction ideas, which he is trying to make come real. Then what happens is the next generation of novelists come along and say, oh, that's a really interesting idea. They write more novels and so on. There's a kind of feedback loop going on here. And I think, therefore, understanding the science fiction is important. And, you know, when we come to robots, this is really important because there are so many robots in the novels. It starts with Asimov and even before then. And these robots are all intelligent. They've all got a kind of consciousness. They're all planning and scheming. And therefore, when we meet a real world robot, we can't help but putting that kind of science fiction gloss onto it.
Even if it's highly debatable whether a sentient, conscious robot could ever exist. I mean, it's almost assumed in the sci-fi that's where it's heading. And it feels like that's been taken on by the Elon Musk. Well, of course, we're going to develop. Whereas that's not a given by any means, is it? Is it, John?
No, it isn't. And actually, it's an incredibly complex and difficult issue. I've been trying to wrap my head around this issue of consciousness and robot. And it's almost like you go down the rabbit hole, because the problem is, we only know about consciousness in a human being. That's our only experience of what it's like to be conscious comes from human beings. And even as I stare at you, Justin, I don't really know that you're conscious. I mean, you could be a zombie. You could be just going through the motions.
Well, you could be the latest AI simulation, John.
Oh, you didn't realize. You just spotted me. Yeah. So sooner or later, there are going to be AIs that claim to be conscious. And the interesting thing is, there is no way that we can ever know for certain. There's no test for consciousness. There's no way. And some people are suggesting we're going to have to set up committees that are, whenever a new software program comes along and claims to be conscious, we're going to have committees which decide, is this actually genuinely conscious? If it is, we're going to have to treat it with, give it rights. We're going to have to make sure we don't damage it or cause pain. We're not going to be allowed to switch it off, even if it gets on our nerves, and so on and so on. And people are seriously projecting forward what society is going to be like when we've got all these so-called conscious robots.
Well, I guess that sort of raises the question of the role of evil. So Roz Picard, who's at MIT, and I don't know whether anyone saw this, but she did a big conversation with Justin and Nick Bostrom and other scientists. And she said, which I thought was really interesting, that people use AI to amplify either the good or the bad things that they're doing. So that, I think, raises the question of evil, doesn't it? You know, where is the role of evil in all of this? And what's kind of the church's responsibility in all of this, John, do you think?
That's absolutely right. And one of the fascinating things about the technology world and the world of science and materialism is that they don't have a category for evil. It doesn't really compute. They understand that there can be things like programming errors. They understand that there can be kind of just random things going wrong. But the idea that there is actually a malevolence, that people or forces would want to do things in a genuinely malevolent way, it doesn't compute. I mean, why would that happen? Why would that happen in a world of physics? And so, interestingly, it's really, I think, Christians who do have a much deeper and a more profound understanding that evil is a real phenomenon, but it's not the supreme phenomenon. It's not, you know, the power of God, the power of goodness is greater than evil. But at the same time, we've got to respect evil. We've got to take it seriously. We've got to recognize that evil can sort of emerge out of neutral technology. And I think the greatest thing we should be concerned of is not so much about evil robots or terminators. What we should be concerned about is evil human beings who can use this technology for their own malevolent purposes.
Yes, I mean, St. Paul obviously talked about the principalities and powers, and by that, you know, I think he was talking in Ephesians about both the earthly powers and the spiritual powers. But I think today you could say big tech is becoming one of those earthly powers. It's something, and Christians need to be ready, I suppose, to understand that and respond to it appropriately.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think so far, I'm afraid the kind of biblical theological thinking is way behind where the technology is. And one of my frustrations is actually it's turned out to be pretty hard to get serious theologians and Bible scholars to engage with this stuff. Most of them think it's for the birds, it's not serious.
It's still so just sort of things people talk about online. But no, I mean, it is, and we're going to come in a moment to something that's just happened in the last few weeks that a lot of people have been talking about, ChatGPT. Just a reminder, though, before we talk about that, because some people have been joining us as we've been having this conversation, you can ask your questions. We're going to be coming to those questions in just a moment. This is a great moment to pop a question in the Q&A, and we'll get to as many of them as we can during the course of today's show. We'll put them to John here. We published an article on AI about a week ago on our Premier Unbelievable website. It was titled, Should Christians Be Concerned About the Rapid Advancements in Artificial Intelligence? I sent this to you the other day, John, just to have a look at it, see what you thought of it.
It's sort of, I thought it was, it's not the best thing I've ever read, but, you know, I've read other things written by Christians which were far worse. I thought it was fairly balanced.
Middle of the road. Well, and then we, of course, let the cat out of the bag with you, John. It was written by AI. So we thought we'd just try this little experiment of seeing whether people twigged. And to be honest, I haven't seen anyone actually twig that this was written by AI. And it's just it just shows you how far this technology is coming. Now, we'd love to just demonstrate how we created this article, because lots of people have been talking about this new AI platform, ChatGPT. It's freely available. Anyone can go on it, register. And it's almost like magic what this program can do. you put in your command, you write it in plain English. There's no HTML code or anything like that needed. And what you can see here is the way that we created this, by just asking it to create an article about 1,500 words, using quotes from a famous atheist, a famous Christian, include a Bible verse for reassuring Christians about the uncertainties of AI. Please also give this article a catchy title that will get people's attention, a single sentence summary of the article, and so on, a made-up name for the author. So you give the instructions, and then look what happens. It literally just starts to write the article for you. And you can do this on any subject. You can ask it to write a film script. You could ask it to create a recipe. You could ask it to plan a church service. Mm. I mean, there's all, you know, the possibilities are almost endless with this. And so this is an article that it wrote. Now, this isn't the article that we posted, because actually when we came to record this, it wrote a different article, actually arguably a slightly better article than the first one. But it's just kind of mind blowing. And I should say it. We asked it to invent a name for this. You know, the author. It came up with Sarah Johnson from Stanford University, but it fooled you, John.
It certainly did.
Yeah. So what do you think about all this?
Well, it's unbelievable, isn't it? Because you know, if you had said 10 years ago that this technology would be able to just out of the blue give quite a thoughtful, well-argued, sensible, apparently intelligent piece, you would have said that is science fiction. And it just shows you how predicting where this technology is going is really problematic. And I mean, this is raising a lot of questions, all kinds of practical issues. Like, for instance, you know, if you get this to write your essay for you, I mean, why do you worry about both at school, university?
I mean, this is going to be an absolute nightmare for teachers, isn't it?
Is it plagiarism? Is it? You know?
Well, it's not, because it's not even, if it was just copying and pasting bits of the internet, that would be one thing. But it's writing completely unique copy every time. That's the point about it. It is quite extraordinary.
And what is extraordinary actually is, I mean, I don't fully understand the technology, but as much as I understand, basically what has happened is that these programs have gone across the entire internet and all languages, scraping up literally billions and billions and billions of pieces of text. But then the machine learning system basically analyzes it, and they have two programs sort of competing against each other. One program is trying to generate AI and the text, and the other one is testing it and critiquing it. Mm. And what it's trying to do is predict what the next word will be in all these billions of words.
Right.
It's trying to predict what the next word will be, and it keeps getting better and better at predicting what the next word will be. And apparently it runs both forwards and backwards. So it's not only predicting what the next word is going to be, but it also predicts what the last word was.
Wow.
And eventually, by doing this millions and millions and millions and millions of times, it then produces this text. In other words, it doesn't genuinely understand anything. It doesn't have a database of information. It's some kind of weird mashup of billions and billions and billions of text. Mm. And again, the fascinating thing about this technology is that even the best computer scientists could not tell you why it wrote that particular sentence. Mm. In that sense, it's completely
It's a kind of
mysterious.
A black box almost,
it's a black
isn't
box.
It? Yeah, yeah. Well,
I mean, there's no doubt that it's clearly ridiculously intelligent, but really helpful in some respects. You know, Justin mentioned their sermons, things like that. I know a church leader who wrote just as an experiment. He didn't use it, but a kind of asked it for an order of service, and it responded in 30 seconds with a liturgy, with sort of call and response, with hymns, with prayers, with Bible passages, with a short sermon. So there's clearly no doubt that it's really useful. But is it just useful, or is it sort of evidence that humans are increasingly becoming unnecessary, do you think? You know, are we all going to be done out of jobs because of AI in the future, John?
I don't think so, because actually every single word that produced was written by a human. In that sense, it's not original at all. It has simply statistically generated vast amounts of text. And because it doesn't understand anything, it's perfectly capable of saying things which are completely wrong. There's a medical term called confabulation, which some people with brain injury do, where they just, you ask them a question and they invent a memory. They just, and it churns out, and it's incredibly realistic, but they're actually just confabulating. And that's what this does. It invents things that never happened. It invents conversations, historical conversations, events, and so on. And the other thing that is, if you actually left this to do itself, it would spew out obscenities, sexual references, hate speech, and so on. So there's a second process, which is an extraordinarily detailed curation and removal. And who's doing that? Well, of course, it's human beings and human moderators who are making sure that this will only generate acceptable text.
Yeah, that in a sense, you always have to have a human at the other end to make sense of it, because as much as we call it artificial intelligence, the only real intelligence is up here in our human exactly. mind, where we can ascribe meaning to something. As you say, the AI has no idea what it's doing. It's just following a program.
As we look to the future, yes, these things are going to get more and more apparently sophisticated, and we're going to find it harder and harder to tell what is genuinely human. But most experts think, actually, when it comes to real understanding, real comprehension, they're not getting anywhere. And actually, there's going to need to be a new breakthroughs, fundamental breakthroughs in computer science and in cognition and maybe in philosophy before machines are ever really going to be able to comprehend in the way that the human mind can.
Well, as I mentioned, please do get those questions coming in. We'd love to have your questions to ask John for the rest of the program today. Just pop them in the Q&A and we'll get to as many as we can. Just before we go to a question, we'd like to say thank you if you support the show. It makes a huge difference to us being able to bring you resources, podcasts like Matters of Life and Death, like Unbelievable, all the articles we put out, the videos, and courses and so on. And if you're able to support us, we've got a special link where you can click through to make a gift. And we've got a thank you for that as well. And it's rather appropriate to our guest today, because you'll receive, if you're able to support us with the link, a special ebook edition of John's Big Conversation Dialogue with Lord Martin Rees. This took place last year. It was part of our big conversation. They were talking about robots, transhumanism, and life beyond Earth. This contains the whole of their conversation, but it also has over 100 pages of bonus interviews and articles. So there's loads to get your teeth into there, and we'll send that to you as a thank you if you're able to support us. The link, as I mentioned, is with is in the chat if you're with us live. If you're watching at a later date or listening, it's still available. Just go to the info with today's show and you'll be able to access it as well. And we'll send a follow-up email as well with the link. So we always value it whenever anyone's able to support what we're trying to do through Premier Unbelievable. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Today, playing you the live show I co-hosted with Ruth, in which we asked Dr. John Wyatt all about AI and living faithfully in a technologically confusing world. And we start asking the questions that came in from our listeners next. But the links I just mentioned to support the show and to be able to get the special ebook still available at premierunbelievable.com/Wyatt. And that link's also with today's show. Do support us and receive that fabulous ebook. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We're talking about AI, robotics and technology in a live listener Q&A show I recorded with Ruth Jackson and our special guest, Dr. John Wyatt. Shall we go to our first question, Ruth?
Yeah, let's do it. I'm going to pick this one first just because lots of people have liked it. So this is from Luciana, John, and she says, I have been really worried about the 1984 dystopia when we see a rise of totalitarian regimes. How do you see that from a Christian perspective? What would you say to that, John?
Yes, well, I think, to be honest, we have reason to be worried, at least from a human level, because this is really what's happening in certain countries across the world, particularly China. What is happening is that the Communist Party, communism generally, has always been concerned about social control and about how to keep a population controlled, how to monitor them and surveillance. Of course, George Orwell wrote 1984 based on his experiences of these very early totalitarian regimes. What's happening is that communist China is continuing down exactly the same line, only now they're using this incredibly sophisticated technology. I've recently read a book which argued that what happened in the pandemic is that it was the ideal opportunity for the Chinese government to monitor their population at a new level using the technology, particularly smartphones, but also cameras everywhere, motion detectors, face recognition, and so on. And so the level of monitoring has gone up to a new level and is carrying on post-pandemic. But the interesting thing is that America has almost as sophisticated monitoring and surveillance technology, but it's using it for commercial purposes. Mm. So you've got these two major powers, both of them doing incredibly invasive surveillance. You know, our smartphones are just pouring out data constantly, the internet and so on. And I think we do have reason to be really concerned. I think, again, the first duty we have is to really inform ourselves about this technology, about how it works. It's easy to point the finger at China or Russia or other communist states, but I think we too are deeply manipulated by this technology. And particularly, you know, the smartphone, social media and all that kind of stuff, it's designed to be addictive. It's designed to trap you, and there are some of the smartest people on the planet are devoting the whole of their attention as to how can we make it more addictive? How can we persuade you to spend more hours in front of a screen? And I think we need to inform ourselves about this, particularly as Christians, and to find ways to start to push back. And that is beginning to happen, and I'm really excited about that. A number of people are starting to make suggestions about how we can learn not to allow this addictive, dominating technology to damage our own lives and learn to push back.
You mentioned that there are some people sort of speaking into this area, but how do we as Christians make sure that actually this technology is used for good and not for evil? What should we be doing as normal Christians who aren't perhaps AI experts, things like that? We obviously want those people speaking, but what do we do as normal Christians on the ground to try and ensure that this isn't happening? What's the church's role in all of this, John?
Well, I think it's really important, but the truth is we've hardly begun. I said earlier that we're way behind the curve, and I'm afraid that's the truth. You know, it's almost like people are now giving away free heroin to everybody, and we've only just noticed that this might actually not be a good idea, and we're starting to see the consequences of people who've just been using heroin, and starting to say, oh, hang on a minute, how are we going to respond to that? So I think the truth is that we're a long way behind the curve, but I'm not pessimistic. I do now see help going. I mean, I think we as ordinary members of churches need to go to the church leaders and say, look, we need help. You know, can you put us in, can you direct us towards material? Could we invite someone to come and give a talk to our children? There are some excellent materials around there. Maybe, you know, just at the end, we could make a resource list of some books, materials, websites, which would help.
Yeah,
because I think
it's
a really important question.
Yeah, I mean, I almost like think of it a bit like, it's not a perfect analogy, but, you know, when tobacco, you know, started to get into vogue, and, you know, by the 1920s and 30s, 40s, 50s, everyone was smoking. And then suddenly everyone realized this is really bad for you. You know, there's these health implications to smoking. And what was, you know, everyone did it, then it took decades, but gradually people began to realize, and the government started to clamp down and to, you know, make it harder to smoke and so on. And who knows, maybe we'll see the same thing in the digital sphere, that as we understand just how this is affecting our minds and lives and so on, it will just force people to take that seriously and to make the changes necessary, even if it may, you know, feel like it takes a long time.
Just one thing I would want to add, and that is that historically, down through the centuries of the Christian church, whenever things seemed to be dominating our lives, things that were good in themselves but started to become too important, Christians understood that the concept of fasting, of actually choosing to say, yes, well, food is good, but I'm going to have a period when I'm going to say, I'm not going to let this become an idol. I'm not going to let it become dominant. I think we're going to have to learn much more about technological fasting. Mm. We're going to say, I'm going to detox for a period, maybe, you know, Sundays, maybe other ways in which we just say, I don't allow this technology to control my life. I'm going to control it.
Excellent stuff. There are some great books out there as well. Here's one. This one from John Bainbridge wants to talk about consciousness and says, could you, for instance, grant that human consciousness is on a wider continuum of life form awareness? So I assume John's thinking, you know, that other animals have some form of consciousness alongside us. Could robots be said to therefore be advancing at all along such a continuum as well? So are we sort of, maybe they will develop a consciousness akin to lower animals and that sort of thing, John?
Well, it's a very big topic and a complicated one. There are many different ways in which you can sort of subdivide consciousness. But a common way is to make a difference between sentience and self-awareness. So there's no doubt that many animals are sentient, that they are, you know, if you do something unpleasant to them and you can see the face screw up or you can see them respond in a way, we assume that what's going on, their experience, the experience of say a dog, a cat, a horse, an elephant, a dolphin, is in some way analogous to what we feel like when something happens. And the whole foundation of animal welfare is based on the assumption that animals are sentient. But we are much more than sentient. We are self-reflective. We're able to think about thinking. You know, we're aware of what is going on in our minds at any one moment. We can stand back and we can also read other people's minds. I can work out that Justin's getting increasingly bored by this conversation just by looking at his face. So, so human consciousness, the only kind of consciousness that we really understand is human. And it's a human consciousness which comes out of having a body. I mean, if you think about it, how did our consciousness emerge? Well, it emerged when we were a baby crashing around, you know, sticking our fingers into things and then gradually working out other people, smiling at other people. They smile back at us. In other words, the emergence of consciousness is totally related to having a body and to exploring a physical universe. Now, how could a computer that sits with sending electrical currents to itself ever develop that kind of awareness that comes from an embodied mammalian species exploring the world? If there is any kind of consciousness, if it's even possible, if it even makes any kind of philosophical sense, I think what we would have to say is it must be utterly and totally different from anything that we have any kind of concept about.
And as I say, and my feeling on this, to answer that question, John, is it would be really difficult to know whether you were dealing with something that was conscious, because I'm sure we can all be fooled into thinking we're talking to a conscious thing. But if you actually get behind it, it's still ones and zeros and following algorithms and things. It whether it understands it is a completely different question as to whether I think it feels, you know, conscious in the way it's responding to me. But that's my perspective.
That's right. And I think the other thing, which is, and this is where the kind of the Christian perspective, because what's so interesting in Christian theology is this idea that the evil one is a counterfeit. The evil one simulates what is genuine. The evil is not genuinely creative, not genuinely innovative, but rather than that it simulates. And I think, therefore, that we have reason to be cautious. We have reasons to be on our guard, not to be naive, that things that appear to be good, things that appear to be to have human-like characteristics, we shouldn't be naive. That doesn't mean to say, you know, I think, who knows what God in his purposes for the universe? Maybe there is, you know, God in has amazing plans for the future that we really have no awareness of. All we can be faithful to is the light we've been given at the moment.
That's really helpful, John. I can certainly confirm that my puppy, for instance, does not have any self-reflection. But what you were saying there about, you know, evil, and we've talked quite a lot about kind of the dangers of technology. And I think that that comes really nicely to this question from Eva, who says, you've talked about taking the evil possibilities of AI seriously, but what do you think are the main areas where AI could amplify good or even do a better job? I'm thinking of how in popular culture, the Terminator is often used as an example of evil, but in the sequel, Sarah Connor observes that the now reprogrammed robot is serving as the perfect father for her son John. She sees that it will never stop and would even die to protect him. And then this is a quote, this is a quote from the film, in an insane world, it was the sanest choice. So what do you think are some of the areas where there's good being done? And is it sometimes, you know, that kind of blurry line, I suppose?
Yeah, really interesting. I think the most obvious place where good is being done is at a much more boring level. It's things like, you know, keeping the chains of technology and so on working. So what's called logistics and so on. Already AI is making a massive difference to the efficiency of many firms, things like electrical grids, like cooling methods, like so many different areas where so AI is working behind the surface, and increasingly that's happening in healthcare. It's already happening that the AI is helping hospitals run more efficiently. I mean, you may think that our current problems we have with the NHS, they're not doing an incredibly good job of it, but I think we will see more and more of this sort of nuts and bolts stuff working behind the scenes. I mean, when it comes to caring, this is quite controversial. So there are some people who are very, very positive about this. They say there just aren't enough people in the world to do all the caring needs. You know, we've got so many older people. We've got so many people with disabilities, problems of some kind. Surely compassionate, caring robots are going to be the way forward. And I can certainly see how valuable it would be to have something that can make the bed, change a baby's nappy safely, do all the unpleasant things, which would allow human beings to do the things they were really good at. But once we're talking about a robot who is sort of helping someone who's lonely, or who finds it difficult to make human relationships and so on, I start to get really worried about that, you know, because it's, again, it's a kind of counterfeit. It's not genuinely this thing that smiles at you and says, oh, I do love you, oh, I do like caring for you. It doesn't mean it at all. These are just words that have been programmed. And do we really want our most vulnerable people, the people in society? I mean, the interesting thing is, why is there a shortage of human carers? Are there not enough human beings on the planet to do the caring? Well, answer, there are. The reason is because the terms and conditions, the pay and everything, the status is so low. If we were able to improve the pay and conditions and the status of carers, I think we could find more than enough human carers. We wouldn't need to have machine carers.
Yeah, it does feel like a sort of sad state of affairs when you've sort of effectively parceled out all your caring for people to robots. It feels like, well, what's the point of being here in the first place if we're just going to end up just talking to non-humans, you know, for most of our lives? But Trevor does have a comment on the back of Eva's question there. And this is on the sort of the plus side of AI and so on. He says, following from Eva's question, if you do look at areas such as energy management, AI is now being used to optimize the settings applied to the heating, ventilating and air conditioning systems in buildings like offices, shopping centers and hotels. And the results seem to suggest that AI solutions do generate better results in terms of reducing energy consumption, improving the internal climate within a building. So there are reasons to be positive in such situations, or do we think that's evil as well? Well, from everything you said, it sounds like you're saying, no, of course, there are good practical applications of AI, John.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I think this technology is a gift which God, you know, has allowed human beings to develop the expertise to develop this kind of thing. I like this idea that technology should be redeemed. You know, you don't just say, well, it's just great, let's use it. Because, of course, it's also been it has this evil possibilities within it. What we've got to learn is how to redeem it, how to take this technology and craft it and change it and redeem it so it is really being used for God's purposes. But certainly I can see, you know, as I said before, how working on logistics, on efficiency, on improving the smooth running of so much of our society, I think AI is just starting and it's going to become more and more effective at that. And I think it is really going to improve healthcare, including things like diagnosis, advising on new therapies, monitoring people's condition and so on. There's a lot of potential for good here.
Well, let's take a question from Paul here, who this is a really interesting kind of theological question. Paul says, if in the future the mind can be uploaded to a computer, what happens to the spirit, in inverted commas? So I guess, you know, partly what do we mean by spirit, but what happens in that case, John, do you think?
Yeah, well, great question. So this, of course, is pure science fiction. This is a real example. This is a science fiction idea that's been around for 50 years or more. The idea is we could take out the sort of the thinking bit and put it in a different medium. So, you know, the analogy is, okay, you've got this wonderful pop song. You can have it as a CD-ROM. You can have it as a vinyl disc. You can have it just purely as bits in the cloud. It's the same song, but the information is instantiated, as to use a posh word, in different physical forms. And the idea is, well, why shouldn't it be true about human consciousness as well? You can have human consciousness in a body, but then we could put it into a robot or we could put it into the cloud. It's the same thing. The problem is it's pure science fiction and there's absolutely no evidence that it's ever going to be possible. And I don't think I don't even think it makes philosophical sense, because as I said before, the only kind of consciousness we know is a mammalian consciousness. It's a consciousness which is wired into having a body. So much of the way we experience, what we experience going on inside our heads, is actually coming from our bodies. It's coming from all over. We're constantly engaging physically with emotions, with all kinds of other things coming in from our bodies. So it just doesn't seem to make sense to say you could take all that and put it into silicon circuits and it would be the same thing. I mean, there are some people who are desperately wanting this to happen. It's become a kind of new form of eternal life for materialists, you know, for people who say there's nothing out there except
it's physics. Become the sort of sci-fi version of heaven. We can all live forever, you know, in a digital nirvana. But for me, the problem is that the whole concept is it's got this huge philosophical question begging about it, because it is just a sci-fi concept that you can take a consciousness and put it in this new medium, when all we know so far is that the only way we've been able to produce new consciousnesses is through pregnancy and birth, and that, you know, and we do not understand. We don't have the first clue, really, what consciousness is. I mean, and there's a sort of naturalistic assumption at the heart of this sci-fi stuff that consciousness must just arise from purely physical arrangements of atoms. And if you can just basically get that right in a digital form, then you're on the road. But we don't know that. That is a big philosophical assumption they're making, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. And then if you take the distinctively Christian point of view, not only are we have a consciousness which is embodied in a mammalian setting, but God has chosen to use this consciousness or this mammalian phenomenon as a temple of the Holy Spirit. So in some extraordinary way, the Holy Spirit is capable of transforming, changing, inspiring us. So that I would understand it in a kind of holistic sense. It's not that we've got a bit of this, a bit of body, a bit of spirit, a bit of soul, all jangling around together. God treats us as this fully physical, fully psychological, fully relational, fully spiritual being. And he engages in his grace and mercy. He engages with us. He speaks to us. He transforms us. He lives his life through us. And we should celebrate that, because that's something that no mechanical, it seems to me, no mechanism can ever approach the wonder of what it means to be human.
We've got a question here from Marco, Leanne, Noah and Naomi, perhaps all four of them watching tonight on the live stream. Says, love the show, thank you. The rulers and principalities have been mentioned. Is AI, intrusive surveillance, the Internet of Things, 5G, are they not undeniably tools or weapons of this world that are perhaps building towards something like the mark of the beast, some kind of end times eschatological sort of situation? And they go on to say, I love the cigarette analogy, but isn't the church sleeping at the wheel, you know, debating the micro detail rather than the actual causes and reasons? Well, the genuine reasons for these technologies are maybe being lied about. Again, they say China is an excellent example. Is there an agenda behind this stuff, and could it be related almost to some of that stuff in Revelation? So what are your thoughts on all of that, John?
Well, big questions, aren't they? I do think that we have to be cautious and critical. You know, Jesus said, you understand weather, you can say it's going to be sunny tomorrow, you know, or it's going to rain tomorrow, but you don't understand the signs of the times. So I think we do have to be thoughtful and critical about what's going on and trying to step back. And again, I think that often, unfortunately, many Christians and church leaders are, I mean, sleep at the wheel is a bit too negative, but I think they're not really genuinely aware of the way that technology is accelerating at a most extraordinary pace, and really not really thinking about the implications. And who knows what the future holds? I mean, I think what we do know is that God is ultimately in control, that God is not surprised by the development of ChatGPT or any of this new technology, and that actually in his providential purposes, he can use this as part of the of his plans. I mean, one of the fascinating things to speculate about is, you know, it was often said that the invention of printing played a key role in the Reformation and allowing the good news and the gospel to be printed and distributed around the world. You know, is it possible that the development of these internet technologies are allowing new forms of Christian witness? You know, the fact that we're having this webinar with people literally around the world discussing and sharing and learning from one another, that would have been inconceivable even 20 years ago. So I don't think we need to be frightened or concerned. You know, so often when God appears in a new way in the biblical narrative, the first words he says is, don't be afraid. He is in control. He is the master. But we have got to be thoughtful and wise and be aware that evil can appear in all kinds of strange places. So I think we need to pray for discernment. We need to pray for wisdom. We need to support one another in trying to understand better what is happening and then how to respond from the perspective of the Christian faith.
We've more listener questions to come after a short break. We're broadcasting a live show that took place with Dr. John White, taking questions on AI and technology, how to live faithfully in a technologically confusing world. Lots of links for you to explore with the info from today's show, including that link to support the show and receive a 130-page ebook of John White and Lord Martin Rees's big conversation on robotics, transhumanism and AI. The link is premierunbelievable.com/Wyatt. It's with today's show. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. We'll be exploring more of the questions that came up in our special show with Dr. John Wyatt on AI and technology in a moment's time. Still to come tonight on Premier Christian Radio, The Profile, church leader R.T. Kendall talks to me about the 25 years he spent leading Westminster Chapel. That was the London church that Martin Lloyd-Jones, of course, led in the mid-20th century, and who was something of a mentor to R.T. as well. R.T. himself has had a transatlantic ministry. You'll find out about his life and faith. That's The Profile, 8 p.m. tonight on Premier, or find it at The Profile Podcast. Next week here on Unbelievable, miracle healing is our subject. Does it happen today? Craig Keener, author of Miracles Today, returns to the show to debate one of his fiercest critics, Dr. Peter May, a retired medical doctor who says he has never encountered a compelling case of miracle healing after decades of investigation. Well, Craig will also be joined by Joshua Brown of the Global Medical Research Institute, who defends two specific cases of healing on the show next week, one of a digestive tract and the other of restored vision. He says they do pass Peter May's criterion for miracles. This is a fascinating show. You'll want to turn up for it. Miracle healing, that's on next week's edition of Unbelievable. Meanwhile, if you want to get in touch with the show about anything you hear today or on any other show, do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to last week's show on paranormal hauntings with Matt Arnold and Cal Cooper. For now, let's get into the final part of this week's show.
There's a question here from Carla, which I'm sure is echoed by lots of parents. And when we're talking about kind of technology and the ways that we can use it for good, young people are definitely one of the categories that you think of, you know, the Instagram influencers who are reaching lots of young people and things like that, sort of going to where young people are. But then I suppose there's the flip side of it. So Carla says, while the church catches up, how do parents have good and effective conversations with their adolescents or children to maybe even avoid the eye rolling that tends to occur when you start to raise these concerns? And, you know, as a youth worker, as a mom, it's surely telling a young person to kind of switch off their phone, not do that, is like telling them to lose an arm. Is it not, John? You're a grandfather, you know. what would you say about that?
Well, I think it's an amazing challenge, isn't it? And as a grandfather, I look at these children and I'm thinking, what on earth, you know, world are we bringing them into? How are they going to learn to cope with technology? There are some excellent resources out there already. A book that comes to my mind is called Tech Wise Family by Andy Crouch. Mm. And he's got a lot of very practical, down-to-earth suggestions and recommendations from his own experience as a father. One of the most important things he says is the problem is for children and adolescents is that what's on my smartphone is so utterly fascinating. And, you know, all these amazing cat videos and TikTok and you name it, it's all there. And what mum and dad have to offer is frankly boring and staid. And as you say, eye rolling in comparison. And the challenge is what Andy Crouch says is that we've got to, as parents, we've got to be able to make what we have to offer, family games, whatever it is, what we've planned for them this evening, even more interesting, even more exciting, even more attractive than whatever's available on the smartphone. So that's our challenge as parents. We've got to compete. We've got to compete for our children's attention and interest, and we've got to generate, or between us, find ways of having things that are even more interesting, even more fun than TikTok.
One of the things I've heard as well, which I think is really helpful, is getting the young people involved themselves. So lots of people have talked about having a kind of family contract around technology, which also means the parents don't do what they're asking the children not to do, but everyone has agreed to it. So it's very much a kind of unity-based contract. It's not just parents are saying, don't do this. It's everyone's chipped in with what they think is a good idea, whether that's no phones at the table, all of that. But the children have come up with that as well. And therefore, they're beholden to the advice that they have put on themselves, which I think is quite helpful.
I think that's absolutely right. And of course, as we all know, the one thing that adolescents are exquisitely sensitive about is hypocrisy. And so if they sense that, yeah, my mum and dad, they say we shouldn't be doing that, but do you know what they're up to when we're not watching? So as you say, we have to agree together as families how we're going to support one another and why it's important, why family is so important that we're going to put it in front even of the smartphone.
Luciana has a question here. And it's again returning to that kind of question of big tech and the way countries might be using this. Sounds like Luciana has a personal stake in this. This says what to do when your country's government is unconstitutionally silencing and censoring anyone who goes against the government. And that, of course, is happening increasingly through social media and that kind of thing these days. And Luciana says, I'm afraid for my family back in my home country now. Doesn't tell us where that is. But I mean, that this is the dark side of all of this, isn't it? Where that it does feel like there really is a certain amount of power now that large corporations, governments and so on can wield because we're sort of so locked into our iPhones. And obviously so much of our media comes through it and we're so influenced by it. And indeed, it can be keeping tabs on us at the same time as well. So what I mean, I'm sure you don't have the answer to this, John, but what where do you go with this? What kind of would you like to see happening in the future to ensure that we don't go down that kind of dystopian kind of road?
Yeah, there's lots of different sides to this, isn't there? I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that, you know, down for 2,000 years, many Christians have been, quotes, persecuted. They've been, it's not unusual for Christians to find themselves in a political or social environment which is hostile. And, you know, that has been happening for 2,000 years. What's new is the sophistication of the technology which is being used. But I think we've got a lot to learn from Christians down the centuries who've been persecuted, who've been in hostile settings. And, of course, a lot of it is just learning to be smart. And sometimes that means that you have to, if you're in a very hostile environment, you have to find ways of protecting yourself or protecting your loved ones. And often that means, you know, using code. I know Christians in a lot of countries who never use open Christian language and they always refer to code. And are using technology like VPNs, virtual private networks, ways of evading or limiting surveillance. At a public level, I do think we need that Christians need to speak out for other Christians. You know, when one part of the body suffers, the whole body suffers. And maybe we in the West have become so complacent about the fact of freedom of speech and that we're allowed to do and to say pretty much whatever we like. And we need to be prepared to stand up for our brothers and sisters around the world. And who knows what could happen in the future? We shouldn't assume that this free internet and this freedom of speech we currently have in the West is going to persist indefinitely. I think it is perfectly possible that at some time in the future, we are going to have to learn new techniques of how to survive in a society, in a political system, which is trying to control and limit our activities.
We're very nearly out of time, but this feels like a sort of appropriate last question. It's not really a question so much as a comment, but we'd love to know sort of what you think of this. This is from Russell, who says, we seem to be in a period where people are struggling with a lack of meaning. And I feel like AI might start doing a better job than we can at creative activities that used to make us feel good about ourselves, thus worsening the crisis. So I suppose, what are your thoughts about what Russell's saying there about meaning? And I guess I'd love to add, what's the church's responsibility to sort of speak meaning into those situations?
Yeah, I think that's a really shrewd and thoughtful point, really. I think it's absolutely right. We live in a culture where many people say, what's the point? You know, I've got material goods, I've got technology, but what's the point of living? What's it all about? And the danger is that if we think technology is going to provide meaning, and even this really sophisticated AI, I mean, as we've said before, it doesn't understand anything. There's no way that AI or robotics is going to give any fundamental meaning. So where does meaning come from? Well, answer, ultimately, it comes from God, but it's God revealed in a human being, in Jesus Christ. And so humanity, original model, not the new advanced technologically sophisticated humanity, but original Mark One humanity, as we see in Jesus, is God's plan for us. And that's ultimately where meaning comes. And, you know, I think there's going to be an aspect to say, if that old-fashioned Mark I humanity was good enough for Jesus, then it's good enough for us too. We don't need this amazing new technology. And what we need to do is to find ways of being more human, more like Jesus.
It's a great place to finish. Thank you very much. And thank you for all the great questions that came in this evening. I hope you've enjoyed hearing from John the answers, and I hope that whatever your tech life looks like, that you're able to go out and live as a Christian a little bit more faithfully in a technologically confusing world. Just a quick mention to say it is an excellent resource, John's new book. It's not that new, it actually came out a year or two back now, didn't it? But The Robot Will See You Now. And we'll make sure there is again a link to that from the chat. We're going to be following up this webinar with an email, so you'll get the links anyway to John's website and such like too. Also, just to reiterate, if you'd like to support the work of Premier Unbelievable, bringing you resources like this, webinars, shows, podcasts, videos, courses, we would love you to get involved. We're all about helping Christians to understand, defend and share their faith with confidence, and also skeptics to explore the claims of faith as well. If you'd like to join us in that mission, we would really be encouraged if you're able to send a gift. And we will likewise send a thank you gift if you're able to do that with the link from today's show. You'll get the ebook, Robots, Transhumanism and Life Beyond Earth. This is the ebook of John's conversation with Lord Martin Rees on The Big Conversation last year, but there's over 100 pages actually of additional interviews and articles, so you can really dig in a big way to these issues. So if you're able to give a gift, you will get that ebook as a thank you for that. The link, as I say, is in the chat. You'll receive it on email, and if you're watching or listening at a later date to this show, it's still available with the info with today's show, and you'll be able to get hold of it as well. For now, let me just give you a quick heads up what's coming up next month on our next live show. This is going to be an interesting one, because we're going to be kind of doing our traditional Unbelievable show format here with two different perspectives on our next show. This is going to be on the 7th of February. Sexuality, Gender and Identity, Two Views on LGBT and the Church. Andrew Bunt will be joining us. He's the author of a new book. Andrew is a same-sex attracted Christian, but holds to a viewpoint where he believes actually he's called to a celibate lifestyle on the basis of his scriptural convictions. Charlie Bell is the author of another book recently, but he is affirming of gay relationships as a Christian. So this is going to be an interesting discussion between these two guys. I hope you can join us for it. You can actually register right away if you want to for that. It's happening on Tuesday, the 7th of February. Be with us live. And of course, we'll have your questions as well for both our guests as part of that. Again, the link is with the chat, or you'll get the link when we send a follow-up email. And indeed, there'll be a webpage where you can find all this as soon as our call is over with John. But for now, John, thank you so much for being such an amazing guest and answering all of these questions, none of which you'd seen in advance, far better than any AI could ever answer them.
Well, you hope.
Absolutely. And there's lots of lovely comments in the chat as well, John, thanking you. And one in particular says that they feel a lot more peace now because of what you said. So that's really good, isn't it?
Well, God bless you all. It's amazing to be part of this international community, and thanks for the privilege to be here.
Well, God bless you, John. Thank you. Thank you for coming along and spending the evening with us as well. And we hope you can join us again next time on the show. But for now, God bless you. See you around. Hope you enjoyed today's program. And all those links that I mentioned at the end there are still available from today's show, including that link to support the show and be able to get the special ebook. It's still available at premierunbelievable.com/Wyatt. Also the link with the info from today's show, along with other links, including the suggested resources that John Wyatt has given us as well. So do check out the info with today's show for all of that. If you can support us, it makes a huge difference, and you'll get that wonderful ebook of his Big Conversation with Lord Martin Rees. If you want to feedback on today's show, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You're welcome to send me your thoughts as well via our Twitter @unbelievablefe, or indeed on our Facebook page, facebook.com/premierunbelievable, where we post our shows and all of the articles and other podcasts and videos that we produce on a week-to-week basis. Loads of articles, by the way, that you might be interested in from the past week or so over at our website. Tim Keller responding on whether we're too winsome these days in our approach to evangelism, and a great story, Running from God, a Jehovah's Witnesses journey away from and back towards God. Read Claire Dooley's story as well over on the website. That's premierunbelievable.com for all of our articles, podcasts, videos, resources, courses, and more. Well, let's go to some of your feedback to recent editions of the show. First of all, hello, Rachel, who says she's been listening to the show from the US for about 3 years. I grew up going to a Baptist church and now attend a non-denominational church, but I have learned so much from your show. Thank you for all you do. I have a friend who's from China and has no religious beliefs. She's somewhat confused by all of the Christian denominations, really has no idea who Jesus is at all. I want to give her something to explain the main points of Christianity, but I'm not sure if there is such a thing. It's much easier for her to read in her native language, so whatever I give her needs to be written in Chinese. Also, I'd like to give her a Bible, but I'm unsure of which one. Any help would be appreciated. Well, I've got to say, Rachel, in terms of giving something to someone who is coming from a Chinese background is not my area of expertise. I could recommend, obviously, books like Mere Christianity and so on as perhaps a starting point for looking at Christian faith. And I'm pretty sure a book like that would have been translated into Chinese. But I have pointed you in the direction of a particular Chinese outreach organization, who I'm sure will be able to provide good resources and culturally appropriate resources as well for someone of Chinese background who wants to find out more about Christian faith. But thank you very much. It's exciting to hear you having those kinds of conversations. In Aberdeen, Vijay gets in touch to say, I'm a pastor at Aberdeen Christian Fellowship, Scotland. I've followed your unbelievable debate since the early days, always grateful to the Lord for the incisiveness of them, and you so capably, gently moderate them. I've also used your debates as a kind of gauge to help me get a sense of where we are in current culture in the West. Please accept my deepest thanks for all you do. Thank you very much, Vijay. You say, I was wondering if I might suggest a debate topic addressing a movement that in my mind is hurting the church. It goes by the name of Hebrew Roots. There are some aspects of it that sound like a departure from historic orthodoxy. I might cautiously even suggest sound heretical. The Hebrew Roots movement doesn't seem to be like Messianic Christianity. They seem to me, if I can say this carefully, Judaizing. May I please suggest a debate on the topic? I think it'd be great to hear one of the way the movement is and isn't a legitimate offshoot of the Jesus movement in Scripture. If the HRM are correct, the majority of Christians are in profound disobedience to Scriptures. But if they're wrong, they're shipwrecking many who follow Christ as their Lord. I haven't come across rigorous thinkers of the Hebrew Roots movement as yet, maybe looking in the wrong place, but I can think of scholars like Seth Postel from One for Israel Ministry, Daryl Bock or Michael Brown, who might address this graciously and vigorously. Thank you, Vijay. I am very aware of the Hebrew Roots movement. It tends to be, as far as I'm aware, most popular among Black and African Caribbean demographics, and that's often the ethnicity that is pushing this particular movement. And there's some great apologists also from that community who are responding, so you might want to look out for that. And we'll see if we can arrange something in the not-too-distant future to look at that as well. Thanks for the suggestion. Thanks to those who've been getting in touch as well on paranormal hauntings. This was Matt Arnold, our Christian guest, and Cal Cooper, our skeptical guest, but both interested in parapsychological research. And Anthony got in touch after hearing last week's show to say, I really enjoy the show each week, but had to reply about ghosts, etc. The Lord Jesus says in Luke 11:26, in regard to people coming back here from the dead, and besides all this, between us and you, there is a great gulf fixed, so that those who want to pass from here to you cannot, nor can those from there pass to us. So Anthony thinks that sort of, you know, pretty much says what needs to be said in terms of what the nature of these apparitions are and so on. It's not the people, that's for sure. Of course, I guess others contest that. And indeed, so did, to some extent, Matt Arnold on the show, saying that he thinks there is a sort of human element to the idea of a soul sort of that hasn't passed over in some way. JD Walters was very excited that we were putting this show on, and I remember JD getting in touch the last time we touched on this issue with Alison Dale with his particular book on supernatural encounters and that kind of thing. JD says, finally, this episode has my name written all over it, ticked all the boxes I've been looking for. Firstly, descending from the 30,000 foot view to talk about specific cases. Secondly, experts who are knowledgeable about the parapsychological literature. And thirdly, theological engagement with the subject that transcends the dichotomy of Either it's all fake or it's all demonic. I wasn't aware of Matt Arnold previously, but I'm so glad he was on and that he's out there doing what he's doing. Already know well and follow closely Dr. Cooper's research. Excellent choice of guests. Well, I can thank Matt for that because he was the one who suggested Callum Cooper opposite him, JD. You go on to say this is an important story to be told about how in some parts of Christendom, theology tries to preserve its autonomy by restricting what used to be called wonders to the quote-unquote supernatural realm, anxious to preserve an apologetic where certain events could only happen by direct divine intervention and hence would serve as unquestionable validation of the divine authority of the church. Theologians insisted that most claimed wonders were fraudulent, except conveniently for those attributed to Jesus and other biblical figures. Ironically, though, this approach sowed the seeds of further radical scepticism, which inevitably targeted biblical miracles as well. It's past time for Christians to embrace evidence of well-attested wonders like crisis apparitions, precognitive dreams, etc., as evidence not that Christianity alone is true, but that naturalism is certainly false. Early apologists like Justin Martyr used this approach to great effect. How can you scoff at biblical miracles if you grant that events like parapsychology attest are not only possible, but have actually happened and continue to happen? There's so much exciting work to be done here. I hope to hear more about it on Unbelievable. Thank you, JD. Good to hear from you, and so glad that that show ticked the boxes for you. I'm sure we'll return to it in due course. Lots of interesting comments as well left with the YouTube video of this one, and inevitably people sharing their own experiences of the parapsychological. Firstly, though, Tessa wants to say the interaction with Samuel from the Old Testament that Matt Arnold mentioned is also mentioned in the Apocrypha. I believe in the latter parts of Ecclesiasticus. In fact, the author of Ecclesiasticus also believed that this was Samuel from the dead, not an evil spirit. By the way, so grateful for the podcast. Thank you. Really needed to hear this. Rekin says, I visited my brother who lived in a very old house in rural Nova Scotia. He had a young family and the guest room only had a large futon on the floor. One night I was drifting off to sleep and I heard something press down on the pillow beside me. I instantly thought it was a large rat and I quickly sat up. Then I felt pressure on my cheek. It was neither hot nor cold, nor had it distinct form, just pressure. I jumped up in shock and frantically searched for the light switch on the wall. It was the longest 10 or 20 seconds of my life as I blindly searched for that switch. Of course, nothing was there. I slept with the light on for the rest of the night. A year passed and I started rationalising that it was because of the extreme darkness in the room. Maybe it was something akin to a sensory deprivation tank where the mind makes things up in the absence of stimulation. Later that year, my mother and her friend looked after the house while my brother and his family were away. One night, my mother, who was in the master bedroom, heard her friend scream. Her friend told my mother that someone slid into bed beside her and she thought it was the size of a child. Also, the friend knew nothing of my experiences of the previous year. Yes, it could all be a coincidence, but when the coincidence is in the order of something like 1 in 10 million, coincidences become evidence. I'm not sure ghosts are deceased people, but I'm convinced something is there that we do not understand. Interesting story. Norma says this, the dead are indeed able to make contact with us. This should not be a problem unless you're a believer in so-called scientific materialism. In the final months of my mother's life, during which she succumbed to dementia and often would not recognize me, she suddenly became clear as a bell and had a normal conversation with me. During that very normal conversation, in which she was just like she had been in better times, she mentioned that her mother was standing next to her. Next day, she was effectively off with the pixies again. About a year before she passed away, I had a visitation in a dream from my father, who had died when I was in my teens. In the dream, he said that it was time to pick up my mother. I observed that he couldn't possibly be here, since he would be 111 years old, and immediately woke up. My mother passed away shortly before what would have been my father's 112th birthday, and her funeral actually took place on my father's birthday. We are so inured to the dominant paradigm of materialism that many people prefer to tie their mind in knots rather than admit that there is a spiritual dimension to life. Here's another one from GMP, who says, in 1986, I stayed for some weeks in London's Great Eastern Hotel with a girlfriend, and on three or more occasions, I heard a rap at the door. She independently heard at least three such raps, and a Canadian girlfriend of hers reported hearing several raps on her door. She was staying on another floor. I thought it was you guys. When I reported those nine or more than nine events to a guy at the front desk, he turned to his friend and said with a shrug of acceptance, knocks at the door. His laconic manner demonstrated unequivocally that he had heard it all so many times before. Perhaps the most striking thing about it all was how none of us was, in any sense of the term at all, freaked out by it. But like all the evidence ever advanced for the divine, the spiritual, the survival of the human personality after death, the supernatural, the paranormal, or ESP, this may be countered with the four words which will always apply: it may be disputed. The Great Eastern Hotel stands where in previous centuries the earliest asylum on British soil, the Bethlehem Mental Hospital, stood. I mentioned to a friend who had no great interest in the paranormal that it seemed to me not impossible that so many centuries of the mentally disturbed residents there might result in a deposit of some kind. After a few moments, he said, yes. Well, all interesting theories. Thank you very much. Interesting stories. So, I think these kinds of shows often bring out these kinds of interesting, you know, experiences. Very happy to hear more if you think you've got a story or an explanation, wherever you're coming from on these issues. Be glad to hear it. Well, that's about all we've time for on today's show. Thank you very much for being with us. Again, if you want to support the show, that link that we mentioned where you can support and receive the special ebook, 130-page ebook of John Wyatt and Lord Martin Rees's big conversation on robotics, transhumanism and AI, that's available at premierunbelievable.com/Wyatt, and the link is with today's show. For now, thanks for being with us, and let me tell you what's coming up next time. We're debating miracle healing. Does it happen today? Looking at actually some medical evidence presented by Joshua Brown of the GMRI, the Global Medical Research Institute. He'll be defending two cases of healing, one of a digestive tract, another of restored vision. He's going to be putting those to Peter May. He's a retired medical doctor who is a Christian, but says he has never encountered a compelling case of miracle healing, even after decades of investigation. Can Dr. May be persuaded? Also joining the conversation, Craig Keener, who's a well-known researcher in this area as a New Testament scholar. And Dr. Peter May is one of his fiercest critics, so that will be an interesting encounter between those two as well on the show next week. But for now, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time.